Welcome to the Inferno Cast. Today's guest is going to be talking to us about catch wrestling. I feel like it's one of the cousins to MMA and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, as it's very relevant in the martial arts today. Today, we're going to meet with Jake Shannon. How are you doing today, sir?
Hey, what's up, Caleb? Doing good.
Excellent, man. I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to have your input on this because, you know, the hushed tones of the MMA and Jiu-Jitsu community, you always hear them talking about catch wrestling. And so hopefully you'll be able to tell us some fun stories and a little bit of history on it and kind of how its relevancy has kind of had a little bit of a roller coaster over the last, like, 100 years. So maybe you can give us some history and some interesting facts.
Yeah, it's we're kind of the redheaded stepchild of the combat sports world. But that's ironic because catch wrestling is actually the great granddaddy at the same time. So, yeah, we might be like that embarrassing boomer that you bring over, you know, to your friend's house or whatever. But, you know, there's a lot of old man strength and some really good information in that system. So, yeah, I'm totally used to it. And, you know, it's just interesting because, you know, being in particularly the position I am, where I've been very lucky and kind of had a lot of great people around me to show me the ropes of this stuff. It is so weird because you will have some people that just so deeply venerate what you're doing and catch as catch can and that kind of stuff. And I mean, it is literally like almost religious, you know, the level of obsession or whatever. And then on the other hand, you'll just have other people that just hate it and think it's stupid and won't have any. So it really is quite a broad, but, you know, I think part of that's the pro wrestling that gets brought into the, and that's maybe the embarrassing boomer part is, like, you know, nobody in MMA or jiu-jitsu really wants to be associated with, you know, spandex shorts. And, well, I guess that's the cool thing now. I mean, I guess Craig Jones and all those guys, but it's catch is interesting. It's really a fascinating little subsection of kind of the martial arts world, for sure.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to give us, like, a little quick history lesson about kind of how it started and how it was established, you know, how did it kind of come into being, you know, catch as catch can?
So, you know, there's a really great book. I try to talk to people about it all the time, and it's probably just because I'm a nerd and I'm super excited about it. You know, I've done a lot of my own, digging and trying to get first-person accounts from old-timers that were actually there. But it was like, when you went kind of into the 1860s, you started not having a lot of information because there weren't newspaper articles or any, you know, that kind of stuff. And there's a guy, Ruslan Pashayev, he's a hell of a historian. And he wrote this book called The Story of Catch. And I'm looking at it now. Sorry, I would grab it, but I don't want to go off screen. The Story of Catch. And you can get it on Amazon, and it's Kindle or, you know, hardcover, whatever. But it's really neat because it shows how catch, even though it's the great granddaddy of pro wrestling, of grappling, of MMA, of Olympic wrestling, itself was an amalgamation of other styles. And so what I liked about this book in particular is that, you know, I knew that the Irish had a lot to do with it because everybody's name, from Riley to Pop Sharnock to all those old timers, were all up in the North England, and they all had Irish surnames. So I knew that there was some sort of influence from, you know, Irish collar and elbow and a lot of immigrants that were coming over from Ireland into the north of England. But what Ruslan Pashayev was really great at demonstrating, and there are actually kind of two different strains of catch as catch can that kind of happened in the north and the south almost simultaneously. It's like how Leibniz and Newton both kind of came up with calculus, slightly different ways to go about it, but it's the same thing, right? Anyway, so the style that's in the north, which is what most people are probably familiar with when you think of the, like, historical imagery and whatnot, that was an amalgamation of what was known as Lancashire up and down fighting, which was really, it was illegal. And it was just like gnarly street fights, but, you know, it was more like gangs in New York. It was that, like, ripping an ear or poking, gouging an eye. it's rough and tumble. We had our own version here in the United States, and I'll get to that in a second. But so you had the Lancashire up and down fighting. But the thing that you have to understand is back then in the 1800s, you know, they weren't that far removed from the Victorian age. You know, I mean, I think you could maybe say there was a bit of overlap. And so they were kind of prudes. And it wasn't just like sexual prudes, but like, you know, you couldn't, if you wrestled on the ground, you were a disgusting pig and just, you know, nobody would talk. It's like, and that's why it was illegal, because ground fighting was really looked down upon. You would do these like standing wrestling, you know, back hold wrestling, or, you know, where you're grabbing a jacket or the belt or something like that, or collar and elbow. So the Lancashire up and down fighters, they were really gnarly. They also brought in a bit of a subcurrent from another disgustingly brutal English martial art called purring. And purring, if it's like a cat spelled the same, purring, it was brutal. They would grab onto each other, like on their shoulders or their lapels, and they would wear wooden clogs and just kick the shit out of each other's shins until one guy gave up.
It's kind of like arm wrestling with slaps we have today, like creative ways to jack each other up.
Oh man, but it was, you have to remember back then they didn't have penicillin. Right. So these guys, this is how, okay, I think people in the lockdown might be able to get a glimpse, not really much, but a glimpse of how fucking bored these people were. Because there was no, I mean, we're all stuck with nowhere to go, but that's because of lockdown. These people couldn't go anywhere because, fuck, there weren't trains or cars or anything like that. There was no Tinder, Xbox, none. I mean, there was nothing, man. So these guys, all they could do was bet on shit. You know, like dumbasses, like jackass. Oh, okay, I'll bet you this, I'll bet you that. And so they would get drunk at these pubs and go and out to the cobbles, you know, the street is what they would say, and just kick the shit out of each other, and they'd die from like gangrene poisoning over it. Like, it was a gnarly, gnarly time, right? So the other thing is they would, then they started adding to the purring, they started adding spikes on the shoes, like golf shoes, and kicking the fuck out of each other. Well, that was in the Lancashire up and down fighting. They would wear those fucking golf shoe things, and it was legal. Wow. Well, like most things, you know, as it grew in popularity, it attracted the authorities, and they started trying to figure out ways to make it a little more acceptable. And so rules started coming in. But really what was happening is it was a poor man's sport, right? Because wrestling, you don't need a ball, you don't need a court, you don't need a net, you don't need a uniform. You just need another sadomasochist who decides that they want to bet to see who's going to win, right? Yeah. And so these poor people, after a long day in the coal mines, would get together and beat each other up for side bets. Well, these were the first pro wrestlers. By pro, I mean professional. They made a living at wrestling through side bets, and some of them were so good that they stopped going to the coal mine. They were making more money betting on themselves as a wrestler. Well, the local publicans, which are like the bar owners and shit that run the pubs, started seeing this big attractions that these two, you know, one side would throw out money and the other one, and then they just do it, and then they, you know, give out the bets and stuff. The publican started noticing, like, oh shit, this is a huge attraction. Why don't I have it here and I can sell beer, right? And those publicans were the first promoters to, you know, not actual wrestlers. They were just, hey, this is business. Let's make some money. The first kind of Vince McMahon's, or the first Dana White's in this, because it was, most of it was a shoot. But you always have to remember that, like, works have always been involved, like, because it wasn't, you know, you could just, if you could figure out how to cheat the system, you could make a killing or whatever, because you had one guy who was on the inside and take a dive. So that's kind of how it started. It was that Lancashire up and down fighting. And then, you know, obviously some Irish collar and elbow. And then up from the Netherlands came this group of Flemish immigrants into the north of England, up by Bolton, which is where most of this catch wrestling was happening, and then leaked out to Wigan, which is nearby. The Flemish weavers actually, they came from the Netherlands. They had their own submissions. They actually had like locks and submission holds, and they added that in. And then next thing you know, you've got catch as catch can. So it gets very popular in England. And during the potato famine, which was like in the late 1800s, a lot of Irish had to leave, right? Because their main food staple was gone. So they went to the United States, but this was, lo and behold, during the Civil War. So as soon as they got off the boat, man, they got sent out right to the battle front to die, basically. Yeah. But, you know, those battles back then weren't like the cool, you know, guys sitting in a hot van in Afghanistan with a drone bombing people from 100 miles away. You know, this was boring ass shit most of the time. Most of the time you were just marching and camping and stuff. And again, catch wrestling was really good for boredom. So, because you didn't need a ball, a net, or any, you know, just another sucker to wrestle. And so it picked up here in the States. And we had our own kind of variety of rough and tumble that was happening as well. And then that kind of got brought in. And then the same kind of thing happened. Then promoters started seeing the value, started putting on shows. And then next thing you know, it gets so crazy big. I mean, in the United States, between World War I and the Civil War, that time period, catch wrestling was as big as any sport, if not bigger, like boxing or baseball. I mean, it was huge, the crowds that were being drawn. But that is also, that popularity already also started happening to boxing. And you could kind of see historically what happened. In boxing and wrestling, they both started having a lot of worked matches, a lot of fixes. People were, you know, hustling the system. Well, the boxers kind of went a different route and they started like fixing matches through booking. So you get tomato cans and you have a guy that you know is a stud who sells tickets and he's handsome or, you know, charismatic or whatever. And then you just build up these other kind of phony guys in these bush leagues and just feed it to them, right? And you could control the outcomes through booking somewhat. And UFC, most fight sports are doing that nowadays. Well, the wrestlers were, well, the majority of wrestlers, the successful ones were like, fuck it, we're going straight up to vaudeville. And so you saw guys like Frank Gotch going on the vaudeville circuit and making a killing and making appearances. And so then you start having it get more and more worked and until you have the buffoonery of the 80s with, you know, these jacked steroid bodybuilders and bikinis and, you know, bikini shorts lumbering around without much actual wrestling going on.
Why do you think it took such a turn from like sport combat hurting the other person to, you know, this elaborate orchestrated, you know, professional type wrestling? Why do you think it veered that way instead of being like just this brutal combat sport that would have basically been MMA 40 years earlier, you know?
Well, there was, it kind of, that aspect of catch wrestling just went underground. I mean, it never went away. It just was practiced mostly, you know, closed door sessions, bets still, that kind of stuff. But to answer your question directly, I think it's difficult. You know, one of the advantages of me actually not just looking this shit up in a history book or microfiching old newspaper articles, I took a different approach. I do all that kind of stuff when I, because I've written a couple books, but I had the advantage of primary sources of guys like Billy Robinson that I was very close to, or Carl Gotch that I picked his brain ad nauseum and asked him. And they could tell you more of like, what was different and why things are like that. And that's just basically my roundabout way to get to the fact that, going back to what I said, we sit here in the convenience of our Amazon Prime, get something in a day, access any piece of information, all porn is free. You can like, I mean, it's like I can get a McDonald's hamburger and get all the calories I need for like $2. I mean, we live in this just freaking amazing, like pinnacle truly of human achievement. Everybody's fucking miserable because they're ingrates because they don't know history, you know, but we live in this just amazing time. It wasn't like that. So, you know, back then, especially kind of we're talking about like when pro wrestling really switched over to worked wrestling, we're talking about depression era economics playing heavy here. And people didn't give a fuck. They needed to feed their kids, you know? And if there's suckers out there, and listen, if anybody is all jaded and high looking down their nose at anybody else, it hasn't changed. It's just, you know, what business is doing that now? I mean, look at like the pharmaceutical companies. They're like killing more people than anybody. But if you dare say anything, you're like wanting to, you know, you're like an evil person. It's a sucker game. It's a sucker bet. And so they just were like, hey man, I got to make money. And by that, by the time the Great Depression was over, it was institutionalized. It was a whole system and people kind of were buying into it. You know, McMahon really was the one who came out and said everything was fake in the '80s, but most everybody knew that, you know, that had half a brain, because you've actually ever seen a real fight, you know, it doesn't look like that.
Yeah, for sure. So how did you find wrestling and specifically catch? Like, I mean, how did your journey put you in the middle of this interesting historical path?
Well, okay. So, you know, if I was younger, I would have answered that question a lot differently, but now I'm older and, you know, I'm 46, I'll be 47 here in about a month or so. And I've had a lot of study of this from a lot of perspectives, not only as a practitioner, but as somebody trying to reignite the sport and recreate the sport, but, you know, a historian, friends to these guys, these old timers. And what I'm, it's weird. I'd like to take credit because, you know, I'm the one in this meat suit, stuck looking behind my eyeballs, experiencing this thing. But this is the weirdest thing. Do you know what 23andMe is?
No.
It's one of those genetic companies where, like,
oh, yes, yes,
you spit in a vial and they put in a centrifuge and tell you all this weird data about yourself.
Right.
Well, I was telling you earlier about kind of that amalgam of, you know, it was a mixture of submission wrestling from the Netherlands and all these Irish immigrants coming in and then doing this like Northern England up and down fight. And it was all this, dude, I was totally into catch wrestling before I found any of this out, but this is like a total head trip in terms of nature nurture. I did 23andMe. I'm looking at it. Yeah, my last name's Shannon. Okay, big deal. I have Irish heritage. Okay. I look at it. This is so weird. Like my paternal haplogroup. So my father, who gave me, you know, the name Shannon passed down, that haplogroup can trace back to about 250 miles due east of Wigan and Bolton. And then on my mother's side, they're from the Netherlands and they were fucking weavers. I know. So it's like, I had no choice. I'd like to think I had a choice. So just to give you an idea. So I have that genetic makeup. Okay. I'm fucked. This is what I have to do. I can't, what else am I going to do? Right. I have a master's degree in math. I don't use it. I just do this weird shit. Like, you know, it's like I think it's like my purpose or whatever. It's like the weirdest thing. But that's just the genetic side, the nature side. So when I was born, you know, my mother was one of 13. She grew up on a farm in Nebraska. And this is another fucking weird thing. One of my earliest memories was of my grandfather. And my grandfather had a cane. He was a farmer, but he was really old. He was, you know, I was like 4 and he had to be close to 70. Anyway, I remember going up to his farm. And he'd make me watch TV and he'd make me watch wrestling. But it wasn't just wrestling. If I tried to run away, he'd hook me with the cane and drag me back. I like had to watch it with him. But it wasn't just wrestling. It was AWA wrestling, which was in that territory, Vern Gagne. Well, that's where Billy Robinson wrestled. So I probably, when I was like 4 or 5 years old, was watching fucking Billy Robinson wrestle during these totally formative years of my life. I mean, it's just the level of coincidences are weird. So. Long story short, my mom put me in peewee wrestling when I was about 4. Dude, this is like 1978. That's like how long I've had like some sort of wrestling thing going on in my head. I did peewees for a while, but my parents divorced or remarried a bunch of times, so I moved around. But I always did martial arts wherever I was at because that was always available. Wrestling or grappling or something wasn't necessarily available, but some sort of martial art was. So all the way through until I turned about 16, I was just into martial arts and wrestling and all that kind of stuff. And I'll be honest with you, I was a bit of a meathead and a little bit of a bully when I was younger. And when I turned 15, like right before 16, I ended up getting diagnosed with cancer. And, you know, at that time, I was already like 6 foot tall and probably, I think I was about 165, 170 pounds. By the end of my chemotherapy and radiation treatment that I had in high school, I went down from 6'1", 170 pounds to 117 pounds. I mean, I looked straight out of Auschwitz. It was like a rough go. And I really ended up being on the other side of of the bully equation. And it really sucked. And so I had to take I was trying to get on, I wanted to get on the wrestling team where I went to high school, because it was it's an exceptional program. I was like, fuck it, I can't do wrestling. So I tried out for track, and I couldn't even do a track exercise, you know what I mean? Like running. So I was just done. But a couple years later, I ended up, again, because I was stuck being at home and sick, I just studied a lot, and it just happened to be good timing. I tested well on, you know, the ACT, which is like the equivalent of the SAT or whatever for some schools. And I ended up getting a college scholarship to University of Colorado Boulder. I went there. That was right about when a Bruce Lee movie, Dragon, it was a bio with Jason Scott Lee, came out. I was totally into it. Like, I thought it was just so cool. And that came out. And then because I was in Boulder in Colorado, the UFC came out almost at the same time. It was like a year later. And I got to actually go, because I was doing judo at that time. And so I got to go, and that was completely revelatory to me, especially because after the cancer, I had a hard time putting any weight or muscle back on. And so I've always been lanky. And to see like somebody like Hoist Gracie go in against like this Greek god of Ken Shamrock and actually win was so fucking mind-blowing, right? That was a huge moment for me. And I kind of just, it must have triggered all those genes, you know, the epigenetics must have got triggered, because then I was just all in. I moved to San Francisco to train with Carly Gracie for a couple of years. It was just too expensive for me even back then in the early 90s. It was like $200 a month. And I was like, I had no job skills. So I was like working 3 minimum wage jobs, trying to pay for jiu-jitsu and a chiropractor, and just impossible, right? And I'm in San Francisco, which at the time was one of the most expensive cities in the United States. I got to train over, I was one of the first people when Half Gracie opened his gym in the Mission District. I never took a class with Half, but that was when Kurt Oseander was there teaching. So I got a couple classes with him. That was fantastic. And then, you know, at that time, I was doing like a shit ton of challenge matches, because that's just kind of what the aesthetic was of the UFC. I'd go to any gym, didn't give a shit, you know, but I could not get booked. There weren't like Grappler's Quest or Grappling Industries or, you know, Fight to Win. That's like everywhere now, and people take it for granted, which is great. I mean, it's awesome. But that wasn't there for me. I just was this like scrub, you know, like trying to get in, and I had no connections whatsoever. So when I was working in San Francisco, somebody gave me a tape, because I'm like a comedy nerd, and somebody gave me this tape, and I still have it. It's the Andy Kaufman documentary, I'm From Hollywood, about his foray into Hollywood or into pro wrestling. Yeah. And I hated pro wrestling before that. But after I saw that, I was like, oh my God, this unites everything I love. Like, you know, fighting and all this and comedy. And so I had a much easier time getting booked in pro wrestling than I ever did in anything else. And I still don't have much of a pro wrestler look. I'm still lanky, but at least I was making money. I ended up eventually training with guys like Ultimo Dragon at his gym in Mexico. I got booked on the Warped Tour in 2001 and got a tour of the country as an actual paid touring pro wrestler. And the irony is that was right when WCW was folding and becoming part of WWE. I ended up being part of the like second biggest wrestling promotion in the world, because we just happened to be on tour and being seen by the same audience as the Warped Tour, which was huge. So it was, you know, pro wrestling was really good to me. But, you know, I started getting annoyed, because I noticed like a lot of these wrestlers, I didn't really have the good look, you know, like the big fucking 40-inch neck and traps and, you know, and stocky and shit. I'm lanky, you know, and that was very much, there were so many like body prejudice things in pro wrestling that you don't have today either. You had to be like 6'5", 300 pounds, totally rocked out. Or anyway, I just was really getting annoyed, because I knew how actually to wrestle and I knew how to grapple and had done jiu-jitsu for a while, you know, for a fair clip. And I got so sick of these guys believing their own gimmick when I could go back to the gym, not in front of the audience, and beat the fucking piss out of them. And it just really started sticking in my craw. And I, you know, would bitch and moan about it. And people would say, oh, you got to look up Lou Thesz. You got to look up Carl Gotch. And right about that time, right around the 2000s, when Sakuraba came through, and that was another mind blower, like when I saw Hoist and Ken. And it was again that, like, almost that redemption from being bullied, probably after my cancer. That's what I liked about Hoist being able to actually win against Ken, but I didn't know Ken was a catch wrestler. And then you knew that, like, the jiu-jitsu guys were indomitable. There's no way. If you don't know Gracie jiu-jitsu, you can't win a fight. That was like, that was as certain as, you know, distance equals rate times time. Like, you were fucking retarded if you did not just accept that fact. You were ignorant. And then to have, I'm like doing pro wrestling. I'm annoyed with pro wrestlers because none of them can fucking wrestle. And I actually had to be the teacher on, that was my first time I ever coached, was they didn't have anybody who knew how to wrestle. So I had to coach these people on this tour that I was doing to help keep them in shape and know actually how to put a decent show on. So long story short, Sakuraba comes around and starts mowing through the Gracies, and I have this other epiphany. Here's this guy, you know, because it was like Vitor Belfort, you know, who was the guy that he fought in UFC, did the armbar, the giant Brazilian. His name's slipping my mind. It's the only fight he ever had in the UFC. It'll come to me.
Yeah, I can't remember the guy's name.
But it was just another situation. Here's this guy who's kind of not totally in great shape, smoking cigarettes and drinking beer and saying that he's a pro wrestler. And he's just fucking like, it's not like he just did it once, which would have been enough. I mean, you know, chemo kind of like drew with Hoist, and that was like this epic fucking thing.
Yeah.
To have Sakuraba just like, it was like nothing, and nobody knew what the fuck he was actually doing. They couldn't figure it out. I was, again, just completely like, oh my God, I need to know this. And so I doubled down and went really deep and ended up lucking out, meeting guys like Carl Gotch and becoming friends, and Billy Robinson, have him being my coach and whatnot. And the rest, they say, is history. You know, I mean,
yeah.
I started out putting out books and learning materials and trying to run clubs to reinvent this sport again, you know, to actually have people do grappling with pins and submissions. And again, I've gotten pushback for 20 years that I've been trying to do this, and now people are finally coming around to it. But, you know, it's so funny, I say this all the time, but you look at the top guys now, like Gordon Ryan and whatnot. I mean, the guy walks around with a crown and a fur coat, and I mean, he's like Ric Flair, but then he's also like jacked on steroids and fucking, you know, in Speedos and shit, like the early Lion's Den, and doing leg locks. So it's, you know, the modern kind of no gi, which again, to me, is just kind of already biased towards jiu-jitsu. I mean, I don't know why you can't just call it grappling. I don't call it no pin. Oh, it's no pin grappling. I just fucking call it grappling. But it, if you let things kind of occur naturally, they end up evolving towards that, you know? So now you see all these guys doing these matches that are very similar to how it used to be in the old days, where, okay, we'll do best two or three. First one is takedown. Second one is submission. Third one is yada yada. I mean, that's how catch wrestling used to be 100 years ago. You'd have the first round was Greco, and the second one was catch, and the next one was collar and elbow or something. So
yeah.
It's really a fascinating subculture and lens by which to look at not only the sport, but also the business of kind of combat sports. And because I'm a firm believer, like, I'm more of a market-based person than I am like a state-based person. So, you know, I look at something like the Olympics, and that's cool, but that's all run by governments and these, I mean, you know, I'm sorry, UFC and WWE and Bellator and all the, and Pride, for fuck's sake, those shows were out of fucking control. They were so awesome. You know, so I tend to favor more of that kind of production versus more of like a NCAAs or an Olympics or something like that.
Right.
And I think the great thing about that is you don't have to go kiss somebody's ass or get a license or something to fucking play your sport. You just go do it, you know? And anyway, so it's an interesting subculture. I don't know if that answers your question. I probably went way over.
No, I mean, it's like, you know, kind of how you found wrestling and just kind of, you know, your journey to where you're at now is just like the intrigue of just getting deeper and deeper into the grappling arts and styles. So I would ask, what do you feel is the major differentiation between catch and other styles? Like, what do you feel is kind of the magic that makes it its own thing?
I really think that, I mean, it's, That's a tough one. I think it is really the rule set, honestly. I think having pins and submissions makes it a spectator sport, which then makes it sustainable as a business. If I look at the sport of catch and try to compare it to anything else out there now, to me, the closest that a competitive catch wrestling promotion would be like would actually probably be closer to UFC, because one, it's competitive, but two, it's very simple for the audience to understand UFC. Yeah, there's a point system. It's kind of based on boxing. Okay, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the dumb meathead in the affliction shirt who's never gone to a gym and never fucking touched a mat before, but goes to 24-hour fitness and throws the weights around and grunts and groans and, you know, that guy. And they love UFC. And I love that they love it because they're the ones paying the fucking venues, paying the athletes. So I love that. But it keeps it simple. There's two ways to win. You can win with a knockout or submission. I mean, right? That's in all the marketing. Well, that's what catch wrestling is, and pro wrestling, if it was a competitive thing and not an exhibition. You win with a submission or a pin. So again, you have this kind of two-vector complexity that you're having to juggle at the same time that makes it a little more difficult than just one alone. But the thing is that, and you've seen this, you've gone, you attend like grappling events, right? Yeah. Can you take somebody to one of these grappling events from like your work or your family that has never grappled? They're going to be on their phone the whole fucking time, bored out of their mind. You have to be a participant to actually enjoy being a spectator on that kind of sport. Yeah. Right? Because it's complicated and these subtle nuances that you only know as a player. You have to keep it simple enough for people to get excited. Oh, yeah, I get it. This guy's on his back. That's no good. Oh, I get it. This guy's arm is being tweaked. I get it. It's no good. That's simple. You know? And I think that's really why pro wrestling has done so well. It's just, you know, obviously it's theater. It's not competition. I truly think it's the rule set, and in particular, and nobody likes to hear this these days. Nobody likes to hear it, but I think it's the brutal truth that nobody wants to fucking deal with. And I think the pin, in particular, not a 10-second pin, not a 30-second pin, a 3-count, both shoulders down pin pushes the action, right? Because if I have both shoulders down and I'm gonna fucking lose, I have to put an arm up. Oh, well, there's the arm bar, or oh, there's a you know, top wrist lock, double, whatever. Or I've exposed my head, now I can get choked, or there, you know, or I can get arm dragging when I pull that arm up or whatever. So yeah. The pin pushes the action. I think that is probably the thing. I mean, it's like I see these matches with Nickel and Gordon Ryan and stuff, and I'm like, oh my God, you guys are so close. You guys are so close. Just put pin and submission in there, and you both are on even ground.
Yeah.
All Gordon has to do is add like avoiding pins, and all Bo Nickel has to do is avoiding submissions. I mean, let's do this. And that's the thing where I feel like I'm like a pregnant lady at like the last week of pregnancy. I'm just fucking ready to get this baby out, you know?
Yeah.
Because I feel like so many people are so close to it, but they all like have this fucking hard on about the pin, and in particular about just a simple 3-count pin. I'm not talking a touch fall pin, because, or so let's say that you're in a triangle or a arm bar or something. Yeah, I mean, that's up to the judge, and he shouldn't maybe start the count if the guy's actually got a chance of countering, right? Like, yeah. We need to make sure it's a control position. But that's the biggest difference. If people started throwing 3-count pins into their no-gi grappling, you could start selling tickets. It's a proven model, in my opinion.
So you feel like it would really push the entertainment value of, you know, make it more exciting, which, I mean, the UFC has done with the evolution of their rules, you know, to make it safer, but to also make it more entertaining. And you know, there's been rumors of how, like, the fighters are encouraged to, you know, stand and bang, and, you know, like, not just make it a wrestling match. Like, there's a lot of talk on the back end where, you know, people are going to follow their game plan, but the more exciting of a fighter you are, usually the better you're going to do with paydays and the crowd. And
you know, it doesn't hurt that the guy in charge of the checkbook came from a boxing background. You know, yeah. So it's gonna lean that way. It's not good or bad. It is what it is, and it's gonna lean towards that. And you know, it's made them money. Like it's, you know, it was valued at $4 billion. That's like mind blowing to me.
Yeah.
But I think that catch wrestling could really hold space in a Venn diagram. You know what I mean? Where WWE is one circle and UFC is the other. And we have that little vesica Pisces and that's catch as catch can. I think there's money to be made there. Problem is that I've found, I tried to build catch based on how jiu-jitsu built itself up after the UFC 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, right? Like, I don't think catch wrestling can follow the same model. I just don't think we're ever gonna have catch wrestling clubs in every strip mall. I don't see it. Because I think jiu-jitsu is more geared towards that, making money in that field, because your average Joe Schmo is going to be happier to be wearing a gi, wearing a nice comfy robe to absorb sweat so it's not as gross and obvious, even though you're still getting it.
Yeah.
They're going to want to lay on the ground and kind of chill out a little bit and still have the challenge, and they're going to want to start on their knees. And that is an easy way for people to get in and build a business where you charge people $100 a month for that.
Yeah.
The second somebody goes from that club to like a high school or let's say a collegiate wrestling club, they're done. They're fucking destroyed. Like, no, fuck that shit. And they haven't even done submissions. You know what I mean? Just the throwing and the pinning is so rough and the conditioning is so rough. So, you know, I don't think the way for catch to grow is going to be the way that jiu-jitsu has grown. And that was a hard lesson for me. I wasted years and years trying to do that. I think we just need a big showcase. I think we need a big investor who believes in the sport and believes in these ideas and can look at the precedent set by history and the amount of money that's been made by history and the amount of combat sports that have come from this as a fountainhead and say, okay, here we go. Here's $500,000 or $1 million production budget. Do what you can. I'm very confident that if we got, you know, a bunch of all-American level, collegiate wrestlers and did our catch wrestling version of the Ultimate Fighter. And I'm going to be real with you. The Ultimate Fighter TV show was fucking pro wrestling. And that's what saved the UFC. Tell me it's not a bunch of fucking dudes having drama in a house that culminates in a match. Fucking, it was a shoot wrestling show in a cage match. I mean, fuck dude, this could have been the '80s, you know, with Ric Flair and whatever, but I feel the same kind of formula would definitely work for catch wrestling and, in fact, allow it to create its – cut its own – you know, so we could stay in our own lane and that it would be its own thing.
What do you think about, like, you know, judo was kind of going through all of these evolutions when it became so popular and they started changing rule sets to adjust for this and adjust for that. And it seems like that kind of went the wrong direction, you know, where, like, judo was kind of it for a while and then, like, it's had struggles as well. And a lot of practitioners – talk about the rule sets, like, well, you can't do this, you can't do that, because they're trying to get a specific look, you know, and a specific type of competition. So what are your thoughts on the trajectory of how judo went compared to what you're hoping catch will do?
Well, I think that might be more of a structure, more of a function of the petri dish that judo finds itself in versus the petri dish that grappling finds itself in. So judo, and this kind of goes back to my point a second ago, that judo tends to be this top-down organizational structure of command and control, like a state-run organization.
Yeah.
You make the wrong decision in that kind of organization, you don't get the same instant feedback that you get if you're running a business and people stop paying you money.
Right.
You could go way down a mistake if you're getting tax funding or some other funding that your decisions aren't immediately giving you feedback when people are pissed off or not buying your product, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's what happens, but you're right. It is the changing of the rules that changes what the sport actually looks like. Right. So it's very, very important on like what the rule set is and what, how things evolve out of it. Cause I mean, you could just see, like, look at the beginning of the UFC, they'd have a fucking sumo wrestler, a ninja, a fucking pro wrestler, a jiu-jitsu guy. They look nothing alike. And then fucking Fred Edish and karate and all, nothing alike. 10, 15 years later, they all look like Frank Shamrock.
Yeah.
The style's the same. The fucking moves are the same. The strategy is the same because they've weeded out all the extraneous bullshit that doesn't fit into the rules, you know? So I think it's crucially important. I feel like I'm a guy selling hand grenades in an alley. It's like, no, this is going to work. It's going to work, but you can't pull the pin to prove it. Right. It's like, no, you just got to do it and then go pull it.
Trust me.
But trust me. It just sucks because, you know, I don't have backing and I've, you know, had to try to do this on my own kind of meager salary while raising three kids and all that stuff. And, you know, well, it is what it is.
You know, kind of back to your personal journey, how do you feel facing that illness at that age, being a teenager, affected you long-term? Because, well, first of all, who are you up until that point? Were you the athlete, the aggressive go-getter, like I'm into everything?
I wasn't an athlete. I was like the jerk in every 80s karate movie. I was like just a dummy bully, not very sensitive about life or anything like that.
So and your emotional intelligence was probably pretty low.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Yeah, dude.
So then when this happens at a young age, what did that do to shift your perspective and how did that affect you moving forward?
Well, I actually had a couple weird illnesses. I've been real lucky. I think I'm up to probably, I got like two of my nine lives I estimate left. So I'm pretty good. 47, two more lives. You know, I think I'll be all right. I might make it into my 80s or something. So, you know, when I was 10, I ended up having an appendectomy. And I went to some quack doctor up in the mountains. And long story short, I ended up getting gangrene poisoning and almost dying. Yeah, I remember I had the surgery in June. And then I was festering with all this nasty gangrene for like a month. And I remember I almost died and they had to pull me in on 4th of July to do emergency surgery. And I just remember in this hospital I was in, overlooked a lake, it was called St. Anthony's. And I could see the fireworks going off over the lake as they've got the fucking mask on me, getting me high on whatever, you know, drug to knock me out and being wheeled in. So then a couple, you know, I healed up. That was kind of the gap, that health break. That's when I stopped doing any peewee wrestling and youth wrestling. And then I stopped. And then after I got better from that, was right when Karate Kid came out. And so I was like, oh yeah, I got to do all this dumb shit. So I wasted 5-10 years doing, you know, youth karate or whatever. It's not a waste. It was really important in terms of discipline and, you know, martial art mindset or whatnot. And then I got the cancer again, or I got cancer, you know, when I was 16. It did force me to be much more philosophical and introverted and introspective and think about what the fuck I was doing. And it really put me on the other side of the bully equation. Like I said, you know, I went from being this dumb meathead that did whatever I wanted and really didn't care much about people to having people like that just fucking ruin and make my life shit for like years in high school. Right. And so that really helped me in that. The other thing is I think the reason I brought the other illness up and its relevance to martial arts, and in particular catch wrestling, is I think I, you know, at a young age was very, I had already done wrestling and then I had all this trauma. I think it really inoculated me to pain a lot. I'd had multiple surgeries, all kind of blood draws. I mean, awful, you know, radiation treatment, like all this awful shit. So, you know, I kind of maybe was like one of those old timers where you're just bored and had a really rough life and actually wrestling was kind of cool compared to all that fucking awful shit, you know? I think maybe there's a little bit of that. I do know that, you know, I'm, and maybe it's because I'm Irish, I'm very fucking lucky. I'm really fucking lucky. I definitely had a lot of PTSD from my childhood. There's no fucking doubt about that. I mean, if you look up like just PTSD in cancer patients, let alone with cancer patients, almost dying of gangrene, you know, having an alcoholic step parent, moving around and divorce. I had a lot of fucking trauma as a kid. And so, you know, I went to the University of Colorado and I'm just going to be totally frank. It was my first kind of taste of freedom. And I mean, I just dosed the shit out of psychedelics, dude, like my first 2 years. I was on fucking more acid. Like it was ridiculous. But, you know, this is where I say that I'm lucky because, you know, I happened just to do that because I was really into the Doors movie that came out and I wanted to, you know, I thought that was cool. That came out at that time. And now they're finding that like all these psychedelics from MDMA to acid to psilocybin are these brilliant fucking antidepressants, way better than any pharmaceutical company can make. I mean, that's really, now that the illegality has been lifted and they've been doing all this research, they're finding this like miraculous thing. So I really lucked out, because I do think actually, you know, it doesn't always work out for people, especially if you're doing the dosages yourself without somebody who knows what they're doing. I lucked out in that regard, but I mean, I really healed a lot of that shit through psychedelics in a very short time, you know? So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's connected to catching someone's pain.
What do you feel like changed in your perspective on yourself? Like especially like when you started the chemo and you started getting sick and like basically mortality is facing you.
Yeah.
Was there like some perspective changes or something that, you know, you just changed the way you viewed yourself at all?
Oh, like, yeah, dude. What? Like, so I was just such like a guy coasting along. Like I was kind of this dummy, not really, with low emotional IQ, as you kind of put it. I think that's very apt. I was very into the just say no, Nancy Reagan, don't do drugs shit. Like, not even critical. I didn't know what the fuck I was talking about. I never drank. I didn't know what I was talking about. Boy, I was fucking serious about it, you know, and was the first one to wag my finger and all that bullshit. And then when I got really ill, I kind of was like, fuck it. what are they talking about? I don't know what I'm talking about. And especially, you know, being on the other side of that bully equation, it really like, it was kind of psychedelic. It was very consciousness expanding for me to doubt everything that I had known before. And so, you know, at that time, I also got very into philosophy. And so I had been like Catholic, like my parents wanted me to, and all this kind of stuff. And you have these moments, especially when you're a little kid, you're like, okay, God's so fucking great. Why does this suck so much? And don't give me your bullshit platitudes. This is some bullshit. This is making me question all the fucking fairy tales I've been told about this, you know? And so, you know, I just started really looking at guys like Nietzsche and another guy that was influential on Nietzsche, a guy named Max Stirner. And it just really went more introspective and philosophical. I think that was probably the best thing. And it made me realize the importance of not just being a physical body, but really applying your mental side, and that merger, that union of the mind and the body is kind of that soul. You know, it's like that whole image of who you are, even beyond the bullshit of identity, you know, of like, so it was definitely psychedelic, man. I mean, that experience was very traumatic, but it was also very mind expanding at the same time.
Right. I mean, because when you ask people, like, typically when I ask people, what are the three things that they can tell you that are the most important lessons to have in life? They're usually correlated to traumatic events. And usually they're at that stage where they're like, they're thankful for that traumatic event because it gave them that gift of that knowledge or that comprehension. And so then the question comes up of, well, if it took you this many years to turn that traumatic event into a positive, is it possible to do it faster? So did you have a period of time in which what you were going through at that age was not serving you, where it was like, man, you know, that this is terrible, life sucks, none of this stuff is real? Like you said, you questioned everything you knew. How long was the period before you found a lesson out of it, or, you know, it gave you a gift of some kind of perspective? Like how long was it before you were like, I now see something I never would have seen before?
Well, it's what you're saying is absolutely fascinating to me. It's kind of like, how do we know what we know, in a way? Like, it's, and in philosophy, that's called epistemology, right? It's the theory of knowledge. How do you learn? And, you know, one of the things I learned, and I'm as overeducated as anybody. I mean, I don't have a PhD, but I have a master's of science in financial math. I worked as a statistician professionally. I've worked in investment banking, mortgage banking, all that bullshit. As a quant, one of my titles was manager of oversight for complex instruments. And that was in the sixth largest mortgage originator. So, I mean, I was doing super nerdy stuff. But I'll tell you this. All true knowledge. Yes, I'm going to get fucking stupid here and make a complete statement. All true knowledge comes from trial and error. Anything else is just memorization. So
it's almost like an internalization of the knowledge versus externalization of the knowledge.
Well, what happens is, you know, this whole process of education in the United States that you went through, I went through, our parents went through, this is something actually relatively new, but it's a couple of generations old. So we think it's older than it is, but it's only a couple of generations. They've tried to institutionalize knowledge. And knowledge is like science. I mean, that's part of the reason I'm totally fascinated with science. And that's why I called my company Scientific Wrestling, is that I'm very into the philosophy of science and knowledge and growth and understanding and learning. And the problem is that the way schools are run today is it's all memorization with no experimentation. That experimentation is where you find everything. We've tried to fucking institutionalize science as well, make it an institution. Guess what? It's fucking bullshit. It's all shitty science that comes out of this institutional science. Things like penicillin, fucking electricity. I mean, everything, most things were fucking discovered by accident. Guys like Francis, Crick and Watson were tripping fucking acid when they found the fucking, when they came up with the structure for DNA. These are spontaneous. Tesla felt that he was downloading the information. This is a guy who did alternating current, dude. Like, I mean, these were brilliant. Einstein was a mystic, man. He didn't have some fucking method. He just visualized himself sitting on a light beam and figured out relativity. Like, that is how you get it. You get relativity from a patent clerk and a clock, you know, a clock inventor and patent clerk. That's Einstein. You know, a lot of this other stuff is just kind of bullshit. So to me, what you're saying is absolutely like kind of, you know, an ideal method of learning. And that is actually learning from your experiences and as you age, recovering quicker and quicker. So yeah, the first time you try to figure something out, you're fucking retarded, man. You don't know anything because you don't know anything because you haven't had experience. You get totally fucking destroyed. And you're like, holy shit, I'm not getting caught in that neck crank or fucking that shoulder lock again. I might rotator cuff. I'm sorry. It's fucking how you learn. Yeah. And that, I mean, I think the grappling metaphor is completely apt here.
Do you think do you feel like that's where the draw and the attraction to martial arts has been from is because of the immediate feedback and the only way to learn is through, you know?
Well, sporting does that. Sports do that, and martial arts can be a sport, but then I mean I don't think doing kata is going to do that in the same way. It's not for the same purpose. Like, if you want to know fighting, you have to go get in fucking fights. There's just nothing else to be done about that. I mean, I'm sorry, you can talk about it, you can write about it, you can ask other people's experiences, but it's not a piece of knowledge that you have unless you've actually gone into these conflicts and tried to resolve them. And that goes for wrestling or fucking chemistry or, you know, quantum physics or anything, in my opinion, is that you actually have to test it and prove it. I mean, that's like something that drives me mad in science is like string theory. Completely not fucking proven, hasn't produced any fucking output, anything engineering wise. It's a jerk off. And just the amount of money of people throwing stuff at this, and this is just like math porn for nerds. It's like fucking Math Hub is like all string theory videos. And it's like, what the fuck? I mean, it's the difference between masturbation and fucking having sex. Like, it's not the real thing. And you're not going to learn anything until you go and get your fucking hands dirty. And anyway, that's one thing. I'm sorry. Let me just say one thing. That's one thing that drove me nuts about where pro wrestling and catch wrestling were when I got involved and why I started in 2007, I had the idea in 2005 and started working with Carl Gotch. Again, very lucky to have that guy helping me out on this. But to actually do what I called the King of Catch Wrestling open tournament, where you could come and wrestle under the pin or submit rule set and see what fucking happened. Mm-hmm. If it's important, and nobody was doing it, right? And so now a lot of other people are doing this and holding catch competitions. But I think that's crucially important, is that sport you know, the mat is like a laboratory. That's where you go figure your shit out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Do you think that there's something to be said for having the opportunity to explore the theoretical before it becomes something, you know, of substance? You know, like if you're always trying to test and create the experiment, do you ever have time to like create the new ideas, like the game changer of like, man, we just never thought about this before, and then find a way to make it happen? Or do you feel like that comes through the relentless experimentation, which basically be like, you spend thousands of hours on the mat, you're going to be the more creative guy than the person that is kind of looking at it from the outside, getting a different perspective, and then goes to the experimental phase?
Well, and I think this is maybe what one of the things, you know, I've done all these kind of like things that people haven't done before in this little tiny niche, right? And I think that people have to realize there. Okay, so there's a great essay called iPencil. I don't know if you have you ever heard it? It's by this guy named Leonard Reed. He was an economist. And I think it's particularly poignant for, you know, this lockdown and the crash of the economy that we're going through. And this essay, iPencil, Leonard Reed talks about, and he was an economist, talks about what goes into fucking making a pencil. Right? I mean, this fucking pencil. I have to mine the metal to make this little fucking tip. I have to go get the rubber from a rubber tree. I have to get the wood, have to get the fucking lead. I mean, just getting the supplies are all industries on their own. Then I got to fucking get the metal stamped and cut and printed on here. And then I got to get the fucking yellow paint and the black paint. And then I got to have a whole sales force. I mean, this stupid fucking pencil, for me to get it, probably touched 5,000 people in some way. You know, they were part of this. And I think, you know, that kind of thinking is important. So I think like having the guy on the mat all the time is crucially important, right? But I would look at that person as like the athlete or the performer, and they need to take their fucking craft seriously, and they need to like really dedicate themselves because other people are dedicating themselves to win the prize, right? But then you have to have the guy doing the promoting. And then you have to have the guys thinking about things like rule sets that maybe they've had experience with different rule sets or trying to create things, and some worked and some didn't. And then you have to have the guys who know how to film it. Then you have to have the guys that are the refs, and then you have to have the guys manufacturing the mat. So it just takes like a lot of fucking people. And I think that's one thing that I've kind of brought, is that, you know, I created the first competitions. I gave people access to guys like Billy Robinson and Fujiwara and these other big names in catch wrestling, so they could actually get firsthand practice. I've published books. I've created instructionals. I've made websites. I've had all kinds of different events. I'm kind of a jack of all trades. Nobody was really doing that and organizing or showing the necessity of that in this particular field. And now there's a lot of people doing that, thank fucking God, and some of them doing it way better than I can in their specific field. Some guys are way better athletes. Some guys are better marketers. Some guys, you know, I created the fucking mace bell, like the fitness thing, you know. Like there's these people who I've just been kind of this jack of all trades that's competent in a bunch of fields and unified it. So I think that it takes all types, is basically what I'm trying to say. You really have to like think of this, any combat sport. It really also helps to not just think of it as a sport, but also to think of the machinations as a business. Because without it being a business and making more money than it costs, it's not sustainable. It won't be around, you know? And I think that's crucially important. And I think it's one of the things about catch wrestling that's deeply entwined with the sport itself, with the martial art, is this business, this like pro wrestling and promoter business. It's very deeply integrated into it. But I don't think that's necessary because catch is special. I just think it's older than UFC and older than even, you know, boxing. But you see it in boxing too, you know? So I that's probably long-winded, but I hope that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's basically like, diversity breeds ingenuity, you know, and I feel like that's kind of what you're looking at is it takes all of these steps that have occurred and all these different people and their roles for the evolution to move forward. And what you're kind of saying is you have to have that broad perspective over something surviving and staying alive, because if it's not economically viable, it will disappear, you know? And we've seen that with different types of martial arts. I mean, even just like wrestling in general with the Olympics a while back, you know, kind of a thing where people were like, eh. And, but since then that rekindled wrestling across the world. You know, I saw Couture in Vegas a few years ago. We were waiting on a plane and he was just like, man, since that happened, he's like, it's just, I've become an advocate. I'm more engaged. You know, there's more wrestling happening. He's like, it kind of reignited, you know, the kind of the wrestling thing in America and across the world. And I feel like that's kind of what you're saying is we need something to ignite it to grow even further, even if it is a little bit of a different iteration. You just have a perspective that here's an iteration that will probably achieve all of those goals, but people, they're going to have to buy in. Like, they got to take the gamble that's like, take a shot. You know, you tried cage fighting, you've done the jiu-jitsu, or we're doing wrestling. Here's this model that can probably meet most of the needs that we all are after, to where the rising tide raises all ships.
Well, and that's really what it comes to, right? Is, I mean, most of science now, I mean, is based on statistics, like some sort of like P-test, Pearson test to tell whether something's statistically significant or not, and yada, 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 what's dictated by chance, what's not, you know, all that kind of stuff, type one, type two errors. A lot of science is determined by statistics, but we forget that statistics was born out of gambling.
Yeah.
And that's what entrepreneurship is ultimately. It's gambling, hopefully in a non-fixed game, right? Hopefully, I like to think of business more as poker, where you legitimately go into a, if you're good at poker, you can go into a casino and walk out with money. That may not happen if you're trying to play like Baccarat, because the way the games are made, you're statistically going to lose over the long run. I look at business a lot like poker, where it is a game of skill, but it's also, you're betting, man. You're trying to guess the best you can, and it rewards people to do so. And that's what entrepreneurship is. So that's kind of what sets out a guy from like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or something to the guy, you know, with the neck beard running the used bookstore down at the mall, right? Like two different guys, same business. One is better at than the other. And it mostly is about taking calculated guesses and then also having good business contacts and stuff. I mean, that's one of the challenges for me, is that because I've been so removed from finance, because I've been, you know, I got three kids and I prioritize that. And that's part of the reason why I focus on wrestling now, so I don't have to be gone 14-hour days like I used to. But I'm so far removed from it. I know that we need a big financial backer. We need our Abu Dhabi Sheik. We need our AEW Tony Khan or McMahon from the WWE or the Fertittas for the UFC or the Cokers. And we need that money. That's as clear to me as, I mean, it's just obvious as the nose on my face. But you're right. It ultimately comes down to a gamble. Does the person, you make the pitch of, yeah, catch wrestling, it's between pro wrestling and WWE. That's $4 billion and $8 billion. Well, before COVID anyway, valuations. You know, there's a big chunk of change. There's going to be a demand for this. I have a plan. It's going to look like Ultimate Fighter. I've got a flashy name. I've got top tier athletes. Brilliant. You just got to find somebody who's like, fucking brilliant. I'll take that gamble. Let's do it. I think I can put in $1 million and make out $500 million, like the Fertitta did. Fertitta's when they bought the UFC. So that, I think that's where we're at with it. But because I've tried everything else, and it's been good for grassroots and you know, like kind of just a very bare bones level. But
it's been more like in, they say, an affair of the heart.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's a like, passion.
Yeah, yeah, you're passion, giving and pouring in, but you're not really getting much back out of it. Except
no, there's no fucking money in this shit. That's the one thing I think is that when I came into this space, you know, all the websites were like shitty and schlocky and the marketing was, and I came in, I just polished it up. I just put really nice curb appeal and showed that, hey, take care of this shit. Look at these cool badass pictures of somebody doing a twister from the 1930s. Let me show you this picture of a double wrist lock from the 1910s. Let me show you a strangle. You know, a guillotine hold from the 1800s. It's all relevant, guys. This is cool. Yeah. It's, you know, so I mean, I've really taken kind of a more of like an entrepreneurial approach to it. And, you know, I've had a lot, I mean, there a lot of entrepreneurs, I think they like to, unfortunately, maybe get a big head or something. I mean, a lot of it's been luck too. I mean, I've had some unbelievable luck.
Sometimes you're just right, you're at the right place, the right time, you know, and then you got to be wise enough to recognize the opportunity. That's but you also have to be wise enough to recognize that that opportunity was like 1 minute away from not being there. You know,
and I had nothing really to do with it. I'm just the fucking witness to it.
Yeah. It's like, if I would have caught one more stoplight, this next 10 years would have never happened.
I mean, in a lot of it, you can work hard, and working hard is important. I'm not saying that that's not a part of the equation, but a huge part is walking down the street and you fucking find a 20. I had nothing to do with that. I'm just like, sweet. I'm stupid to timing. Not pick up this $20 bill.
Yeah. Sometimes it's timing. There's a guy that's a, he helps small businesses grow, and he's done 7 businesses that got a valuation over $1 billion, which is a very big deal. But he tells a story of whenever he came up with the idea of streaming television, and they started it in California, and they had backers, they got Hollywood, they had a couple stars involved. But the problem was only 20% of people in the United States had like T1 capabilities at all. And they were just holding on and holding on and holding on. And they finally, it just ran out of money. They had to bankrupt, they shut it down. And literally 8 months later, they had found, you know, fiber optics kicked up, you know, and the T1 line spread, and then like the whole streaming thing took off, you know. He was like, we were 6 months away from being first, but sometimes the timing is just off, you know.
It's so crucially important. I mean, that is like, so, and that's the heartbreak, because I've been an entrepreneur for almost 20 years now, making a living, not on a steady paycheck from anybody else. I'm out hustling up. And it's hard as fuck. I'm just going to be real. It's like one of the hardest things I've ever done. I'm used to it now after 20 years. Yeah. But
you're numb to the pain. It's like wrestling.
That is the heartbreak of an entrepreneur. That's what is really killing me about it. I don't want to politicize this at all. But I do want to put my sympathy out, obviously, for the people that are having problems with this illness. But man, I don't know that anybody's thinking about the people, the mom and pops that put in 20, 30 years into a business, maybe a restaurant or something. And, it, you know, they're very small margin businesses. It doesn't take a lot to put somebody out of business. They've been busting their ass, putting everything into it, their entire future into it, to having it just fucking, you know, something. Yeah. They're saying like 50% of small businesses are going to go away. It's like,
I read a statistic a while back that said the average entrepreneur has less than 90 days afloat, you know, most of the time.
In the
it's cyclical, I mean, you know, cyclical.
We're seeing it. We're seeing it, right? Because they shut down everybody's revenues for like 3 months, and nobody's coming back. It's going to be weird.
Difficult time, you know, but hopefully we'll be able to take this time and grow from it, much like what you did with your own issues when you were younger. That was a difficult, challenging thing that you've been able to turn into a very fruitful life and a passion and goals, and kind of spread that on to others. Really appreciate you taking time to talk to me today. Is there anything you'd like to finish with?
No, man, this was just a great conversation. I appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, I had a really good time. We'll definitely keep in touch, and hope you have a great day.
Thank you, sir. Bye, Cam.